Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Joel McCower from GreenBiz.com and Clean Edge, two companies with which I'm affiliated. And we're here to talk about eco-entrepreneurs and eco-markets. If you went to the session yesterday morning, the plenary session, Green is Green, with Ray Anderson and Lorraine Bolsinger, whether you did or not, they talked about the three waves of sort of business and the environment that have been taking place. I've been in this space as a writer and consultant and speaker and strategist for about 20 years, and have really watched things evolve from if you go back sort of to the first wave, it was sort of a eco-Hippocratic oath for companies, sort of first do no harm, and then it became sort of doing well by doing good, which is sort of let's figure out how to, you know, improve our bottom line, improve efficiency through pollution prevention and waste reduction, energy efficiency, and things like that. And the third wave that was talked about yesterday is they were calling it Green is Green, which is how do you move from thinking about the environment as a way to improve the bottom line to actually grow the top line. In other words, using the environment as a vehicle for innovation and new products and new markets. And that's in the big company world. That's in the multinational companies and, you know, pretty large sized companies. But in the smaller company, in the world of small and medium sized companies, there's an analog to that. They don't have sort of the historical problems of the, you know, first do no harm of the pollution cleanup and how to really stop all that, because these are generally not scrubber and filter and smokestack and drain pipe kinds of companies. But so the first wave of this is sort of the doing well by doing good. It was companies that are just starting to do something better, whether it was just internal products and internal processes of recycling or making things recyclable, sometimes redesigning their products a little bit. But just starting to be greener, if you will. The next wave, which is really, I think, in the mid and late 90s, is almost an apologetic capitalism kind of thing, where we're a good company, we're doing good things, we're making money, but we're not really interested in that much. But we really want to just do good for the planet or society. But now there's a third wave as well, and it's really where eco and social entrepreneurialism is taking force, and it's a new wave, and in some cases, a new generation of entrepreneurs who are really starting to think about how do we transform, how do we build companies, how do we build companies that are unapologetically capitalistic in various ways, and that have some product and service that really has a place in the marketplace. But also has some other benefits, some aspect of it, either by the way they're made or the kind of good they do in the world. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And there is this, it's a very exciting time because we've been watching this. I work with early stage companies and with some of the venture capitalists and angel investors that invest in them. And there's a huge amount of money that's starting to get interested in this and starting to make investments in early stage companies. And so I want to look at that and see where that's going and what's behind this, who's behind this, what are some of the things that are going on, what are some of the barriers that are in its way, and what's the real potential here for these kinds of companies to have an impact? How much can small companies, what kind of difference can they really make? And I think also interestingly, perhaps we can talk a little bit about what we can all do to support and nurture this kind of emerging capitalism in our society. So we have two panelists here who I am pleased to have not just as panelists, but also as colleagues and friends. I've known both of them for some time. I'll introduce them briefly because they're going to really introduce themselves in a little bit more. But at the end of the table here is Jonathan Greenblatt. I got the name right. I introduced him at another panel last year, and I got his last name wrong, which is really bad, in front of his wife even. Jonathan is co-founder of a company that called Ethos Water that he and a colleague started and later sold to Starbucks, and he'll tell you that story. And Andrew Beebe is the president and chief operating officer of a company called Energy Innovations, which is in the solar energy market. I'd like to have you start, both of you, at the beginning, as all good stories should. Tell us a little bit about a brief story of the pathway that got you here, and I also want to point out that there's a couple differences and similarities here. Both of them come from the dot-com world. Both of them are successful entrepreneurs who discovered or came to be in this space. But they're also, I think it's, before you get started, just one other thing that I think is interesting is that unlike the dot-com world in which you're really looking at untested products for untested markets and untested entrepreneurs, and yet some of them succeeded and a lot of them didn't, we're talking in this case about companies that are in playing in trillion-dollar market spaces, water and energy. And so I think it's really important to contrast those two worlds. But I'm sorry, let me get started with you, Jonathan. How did you come to create Ethos, and how did Ethos become part of Starbucks?
Well, thank you, Joel, for the very kind introduction, for getting my name right, which is definitely very important. And I think to talk to you about Ethos Water today, I kind of have to start actually talk to you just a little bit about the world water crisis, which is arguably the largest public health issue of our time, and yet it's something that here in the United States, perhaps this audience accepted because Aspen is such an exceptional place, but most Americans just aren't very familiar with, because it's an issue that really doesn't affect us here in the United States, where there is nearly ubiquitous potable water everywhere you go. But for most of the planet, that simply isn't true. There are about 1.2 billion people who live without clean drinking water. There are about 2.5 billion people, that's 40% of the world's population, who don't have adequate sanitation. That means they likely defecate in the same water source where they bathe their children, where their goats drink the water and urinate. They also wash their clothes in that water source and probably use that as well to prepare their food. Now, unless you're in an urban slum situation, where the conditions are even worse. So people here often don't realize that a child dies on average every 14 seconds from a water-related disease. And these diseases, like simple things like diarrhea, are the leading cause of infant mortality on the planet. And in rural areas like, say, sub-Saharan Africa, women often walk's an interesting way of putting it, 6 hours a day, or 6 miles a day, excuse me, to get water for their families. And we're not talking about a leisurely stroll, you know, in your Tevas or whatnot, down to Pepke, right? We're talking about getting up at the women, often with children, getting up at the crack of dawn before the sun comes up, because these tend to be in very arid, hot environments, in bare feet, and then walking over difficult terrain, often holding a child, or their small children accompanying them, because it's another pair of hands, another set of feet. And then going to a water source, and if there is water there, they're waiting in the queue with lots of other women and children. And when they get that water, they put it in a vessel of some sort, maybe a plastic can that used to hold chemicals or oil, maybe a gourd or something like that. And then they put that vessel on their head or over their back, and then they do that hike home, 20, 30, 40 pounds added to their weight. Now you can imagine that this kind of activity every day takes a physical toll on these women and these children. And this water crisis has broader impacts, right? It reduces literacy rates because it keeps children out of schools. It has wide impacts on the social structures, which are weakened because, again, it's sort of it's the difficult journey these women face instead of taking care of the families. It creates political instability. So it's a real problem. But what's interesting, it's a solvable problem. I don't know if anyone here has any idea. What would you guess is the average cost to provide someone in the developing world with a lifetime supply of clean water? If you know the answer, don't say it. Yeah, Cameron, you can't say it. Anyone to hazard a guess?
$100.
$100. It's a good guess. Anybody else? $25. $25. $25. The average cost to provide someone with a lifetime supply of clean water. Now, definitely, the number varies depending on where you're located. But that's an average looking at different developing countries. So when you understand that it's a massive problem, yet one that can be addressed, your mind starts going places, particularly when you think about something we've all been drinking here all week, which is bottled water, which is an $8 billion industry in the United States alone. $8 billion. Didn't really exist 20, 30 years ago, right? Today, it's the fastest growing beverage out there. It'll surpass carbonated soft drinks in just a couple of years as the most consumed beverage in the world. We can talk about the environmental impacts of that later. But imagine 150 million people in this country who drink bottled water every day, and then a billion plus people around the world who don't have clean drinking water. And so that essentially is the genesis of Ethos, is how can you create a product that links and empowers people here to make a difference in the lives of people around the world. So the business started operationally after my business partner, a gentleman named Peter Thum. He was working for McKinsey & Company, the consulting firm, was on an engagement in South Africa, had visited the townships, which are, for anyone, has anyone been to the townships in South Africa? How would you describe them?
Undescribable.
That's a tough act to follow, but.
All right, pretty bright in the evenings. That's another thing.
Pretty bright.
You know that
Situation. So these are some of the most impoverished pockets of humanity in the world. And Peter, who hadn't spent much time in developing countries really at all, had this firsthand experience of seeing how these people were living. He had a beverage background and thought, maybe there's something that we can do. So he and I knew one another from business school. At the time, I was running a division of a software company. And we started to do some market research. And we found, maybe not surprisingly, that most of the bottled waters that people drank, things like what Joel has in front of him, with all due respect to the Resniks, don't have any emotional appeal to consumers. Most consumers buy bottled water, and you can ask yourselves this question as you sit here, on the basis of price and convenience. What's in front of me at the convenience store? What's on sale when I go down to the supermarket or at the club store? So we thought there was an opportunity to create a brand, Ethos Water, that would have a dual mission to help children get clean water, which we would achieve by donating 50% of our profits, and at the same time, to raise awareness about the world water crisis here at home, which is important because, again, poll after poll shows that Americans put lots of other problems way above water. And as well, maybe they should, right? We all probably know someone who's been affected by AIDS or breast cancer or homelessness or leukemia. List goes on. But again, water, considering all of its ramifications, has big impacts. So we hope to achieve the issue of raising awareness by using our brand to educate consumers, to give them information, and hopefully make an emotional connection, which we were excited about. So we grew the business. Actually, it was a real startup. We bootstrapped it, started in my son's bedroom, my house in L.A. So not surprisingly, perhaps, we couldn't get any investors for this business. I actually first met Joel probably in 2002 when we were trying to hustle for dollars. And we went to venture capitalists, and we went to angel investors, and we went to institutionals, and we talked to foundations, and we went to even the social angel. There is such a world. And again, we had investors say to us, let me just get this straight. You're first-time entrepreneurs. Yep. You want to go up against global multinational corporations like Coke, Pepsi, and Nestle? I said, yep. You're just going to sell water. There's nothing different about it? Yep. Oh, and then you want to give away half the profits. Yes, that's right. So suffice to say, almost everyone said no. We did somewhere between maybe 175 and 200 meetings, and were denied, you know, almost every time. So we just made the business work because consumers again and again said to us, wow, you mean I drink this water and someone gets clean water? And we would see the light bulbs go off in consumers' heads. So we just bootstrapped it and grew it store by store, launching it in Southern California. Started having a lot of success in places like Whole Foods and Cost Plus. Actually, we were able to bring in a big investor who helped us to scale. And then it was a pretty exciting time, particularly when we were approached by Starbucks. Now, we thought Starbucks would be a great partner through which to distribute our water. There seemed to be Starbucks opening, you know, every second of the day, everywhere you look. How could we go wrong? And we went to Starbucks initially ourselves and said, you know, you really should carry Ethos Water. Water's core to coffee. 97% of a cup of coffee is water. Water is a big issue in the countries where you source your coffee and tea. They all align along that equator, and that, you know, those are water-stressed countries. Water is a good issue for you to think about as you're growing globally as well. Because Starbucks is looking at its growth opportunities in China, in India, and Brazil, all water-stressed in various ways. So they came back to us and said, we don't want to sell your water. We want to buy your brand. We want to make it part of the Starbucks sort of family. Well, that was pretty exciting, a bit scary, because it certainly wasn't what we had anticipated. But we said, okay, we will do this if we can agree that you will continue to fulfill and actually scale our mission, helping children get clean water and raising awareness about the world water crisis. And so we negotiated a deal. And the deal allowed Starbucks to buy the company with two main conditions. Number one, they would donate at least a nickel, for every bottle that we would sell, whatever size bottle, wherever we would sell those bottles, for time immemorial. It would be a fundamental part of the brand, period. And number two, that they would continue our campaign to raise awareness about the issue and try to create consciousness among the consumers. And this is really where we saw the opportunity. Like I was saying a moment ago, there are lots of Starbucks. Five new Starbucks open every day. There are about 11,000 now around the world. There are 8,000 here in the United States. About two-thirds of those are owned by the company. A third are franchised, like the Starbucks up by the gondola here in Aspen.
There's a joke in Seattle that they passed a law saying you cannot open a Starbucks inside another Starbucks.
It's true. I've actually seen that legislation. It's a good piece of work. And there are 40 million people walking through those stores every week. And that was where we saw the opportunity. If we could convert 5,000-some-odd Starbucks into classrooms and have 40 million students walking through them every week and just touch a few of them and communicate about the world water crisis, perhaps we could enable activism. Perhaps we could turn on some people to the issue and get involved, and then we really could build some momentum to address this problem, because no matter how much money we would donate, and I will tell you, we will donate a lot, we couldn't solve the problem. So quickly, what's happening today? The business has grown really well. We were pretty small when we sold the company to Starbucks. This year we'll do about $50 million in revenue, so it's a nice uptick. We just announced two new grants. We work through non-governmental organizations around the world. We announced $1.1 million grant to WaterAid to work in Ethiopia, and $1 million investment through a group called Mercy Corps to bring clean water to communities in need in Indonesia. So that's great. And lastly, maybe most excitingly, we just concluded a negotiation with Pepsi. And Pepsi, as you guys probably know, knows a thing or two about getting bottles and beverages to market. So Pepsi will assume the distribution and the marketing and the sales of Ethos Water in the next 12 to 18 months, which will allow us to go from the 5,000-some-odd Starbucks that we're located in today, as well as some Whole Foods and Targets, to somewhere between 100,000-plus stores in the next 12 to 18 months. So the distribution will grow dramatically. And that's what's so exciting, I think, because we truly have a chance to, I think, move the needle on awareness on this issue in a way that's profound and build the first bottled water brand with true emotional appeal to a generation of consumers.
I have a lot of questions, and I'm only going to ask one now, and we move on to Andrew. I think at the very beginning, you were trying to, you know, how do we get this thing known? How do we get some visibility for this? It's yet another brand of water.
Yeah.
What role did sort of star power or Hollywood? You were right there in the middle of it all. Was that part of what got this going, or how did you get that visibility?
It's a good question. Being in Los Angeles, and both Andrew and I are located in Southern California, having Hollywood in your backyard, so to speak, is almost an unfair advantage, particularly because I think there is a community of people in Hollywood who are environmentally inclined, if you will, and also big believers in sort of the conspicuous consumption model, right, showing off how good they are. It's a big deal in Hollywood. And so we did, because we had no money, we couldn't do traditional marketing. So we did guerrilla marketing through Hollywood quite a bit. We launched our brand in a place called Fred Siegel. Are you familiar with Fred Siegel? Sort of a trendy store in Santa Monica in Hollywood where celebrities pay $200 for T-shirts, if you can believe that. And they were willing to pay $250 for bottles of water, which was nice. And we did things like the Academy Awards. We were at the Academy Awards. We've been there for the last 3 years. Now, we couldn't afford to spend the kind of money that Perrier that year was spending in 2003 on the Academy Awards. They spent $150,000 to put some poor schlump on the end of the red carpet with bottles of Perrier, with the hopes that the celebrities, as they would walk by as they got out of their limos and town cars, might grab a bottle of Perrier and be photographed on the red carpet with a bottle of Perrier. Again, they paid six figures for that potential opportunity. Well, we didn't have anything nearly to that. But we found an NGO, which Andrew knows well, Global Green, great green-oriented group in based in LA that was sending some of the more environmentally conscious celebs to the Academy Awards in Priuses. They wanted to make a statement, again, not show up in gas-guzzling limos. So we stocked those Priuses with Ethos water. So for the cost of just a couple cases of water, we had people like Cameron Diaz, Leonardo DiCaprio, Sting, Tom Hanks, Will Ferrell, the whole lot of them, walking down the red carpet with Ethos. So again, I think Hollywood has its issues, as we've heard about this week. It also has advantages, and it does have the power to communicate, and we took advantage of that.
Thanks. Andrew Beebe, solar power isn't something that you can hand to stars at the end of a runway. It's a very different...
We have them wear our panels.
Yes, wear our panels, right.
Walk in.
But let's talk about your path from founding a dot-com and successfully exiting from that to starting a solar company.
Sure. I sometimes think solar's a noble pursuit and something I can feel good about, and then I hear stories about why you do what you do, and I'm blown away and humbled. So I was born in the Women's Hospital in New York City. No, we don't need to go that far back. Okay. 10 years ago, when I was 25, I started a startup, a technology startup in Silicon Valley, based on a bunch of sort of fundamental broad-scale mega or market trends that were taking place. They were things like the increase in internet access. So we saw more and more people using the internet. Things like the lowering cost of disk drive space and bandwidth connectivity, things like data centers coming on board. And you could sort of draw a bunch of those trend lines down, and you would find a point where they would converge and realize very quickly that you would have a lot of different types of people, in my case, having small businesses start to use the internet to communicate with their customers and build their own businesses, sort of homesteading on the internet. And so we started Big Step in 1996 on that premise. And it was an interesting time as well, and I think there are a lot of parallels to that beginning to what's happening now in clean technology and in entrepreneurship in clean technology. I went up and down Sand Hill Road. I was, I think you said all those things, untested entrepreneur, untested product, really untested market. And we got kicked out of most firms based on actually the last one, the untested market, or at least that's what they would tell us. It was probably the first one. And the market question was, will small businesses ever really use the internet? You know, will people really put their credit cards online? Now, this was Amazon was just sort of coming up, and people thought, well, maybe that'll happen. You might buy a book, but are you going to look up a dry cleaner? Are you going to buy things from small businesses? And obviously, you know, sort of the rest is history. We ended up having venture capitalists change their minds. We raised $70 million. We built a real company, and it is now profitable and part of a larger company. And a lot of those, I mean, virtually all those things came true. They took a little bit longer than I expected, especially broadband access. But it is now global, and it's now happening. I see a lot of the same trends in clean tech, and I guess my message, I'm hoping there are entrepreneurs I know, like Mike, who runs Post Ranch Inn, there are entrepreneurs in the room who are doing this now and bringing greenness and sort of, I think, a global sense to their work. And I'm hoping that the message is clear that the water's, you know, great, jump in, come on in. There's plenty of upside. Water's great. In the U.S., it's potable. But there's plenty of upside here in a whole bunch of different directions. And so after selling Big Step, I spent a year with Joel, learning a great deal from Joel and looking at all sorts of startups around the clean tech space. And the reason actually was because of water. I haven't told you the story, but I read a book by Freeman Dyson. I understood about a tenth of it. And I actually had read a book by Brian Greene at the same time, and I understood about 1% of it. It was like that Chinese meal. It was a good one.
You had to be there.
Yeah, you had to be there. So after reading that, Freeman Dyson put together a really simple idea. You know, if we can make power cheap enough, we can actually desalinate water all over very quickly in location. And now Dean Kamen and others are trying to get that done with these types of technologies. That was my inspiration. From there, I looked at sort of a broad swath of technologies, and I settled on solar. And the reason I settled on solar was because I saw a lot of truly mirrored trends from 10 years before. So, for example, there is a broken infrastructure in our grid system. It's not truly broken. It's actually functional broken. But it is the costs of transforming that are going to be massive, and it's built on a command and control centralized infrastructure system that has served us very well for 50-plus years. But now technologies are allowing us to change that, largely because of the work of the grid and the work that utilities have done. We can now decentralize power very cost-effectively. We can push power back onto the grid in most states so we can run our meters backwards. And in California, we do that. Does anyone have solar on their rooftops? Right. So, and in California or
Hawaii,
right. So in Hawaii and California, you can run the meter backwards and actually use the grid as your battery. So with regulation, we've solved a lot of the basic problems. So we are following, I think, a decentralized or decentralization model just like we did with the Internet. And we are actually looking at a sort of distributed computing model for energy in the future. We will always have big computer systems like data centers and switches and telco systems that are large and centralized, and we will always have large power generation plants and probably more and more of them. But at the same time, we are now building enough of an infrastructure that we can actually move to this decentralized model. And that trend is one that is not bought in by everybody in the power industry. And so for the same reasons, just like 10 years ago, you look at that, and then you look at the ability, the sort of awareness around solar. You look at the cost going down and that trend line having a very clear and demonstrable endpoint where it actually gets cheaper than conventional sources, and you have, I think, the makings of a great great startup environment, and the kind of environment where people like us can jump in now and say, look, all we have to do is bring that point in, that inflection point where we are cheaper than conventional sources, and that arbitrage makes a lot of money. And it obviously changes the world at the same time, but it's a huge financial upside opportunity. So those little transformational components, like the cost curves coming down just like 10 years ago, access, awareness in this case, going up, things like regulation, allowing interconnects and other things, and then obviously at the grand scale, sort of a broken or breaking infrastructure that's going to have a harder and harder time rebuilding itself, create incredible market environments for startups. And so we started in 2001. My partner Bill Gross started Energy Innovations, and I came on a year later and subsequently had very similar conversations, went up and down Sand Hill Road, and, you know, the conversations, this is just 5 years ago, the conversations were, is the power issue really a big deal? Hasn't the grid fixed itself? We're not really going to have any more crises in California. And by the way, you know, oil is cheap and things are fine, you know, generally, globally on the energy picture. And, you know, there's some scaremongering going on, but it's not that big a deal. And now, you know, just 5 years later, you have, you know, Vinod and John Doerr and others, you know, taking truly global leads. And they started that just, you know, in 2001 and 2 as well, but taking global leads on the investment opportunities here. And so, again, I think my message is we started one solar company, but there are tons and tons of other solar companies. We didn't, when we started Big Step, the market was very unknown and hard to explain or even quantify. And now I have the great pleasure of, you know, telling, my venture pitch is pretty easy. There's a big pie, and it's a $2 trillion pie. It's the largest market in the world. It's never had a down day of growth in the history of humanity. Every day we use more power than we did yesterday. So this is an exciting place to be, right? And right now solar is, well, you can't even see the line because it's such a small slice. And yet realistically, over the next 50 to 100 years, it really could be a huge portion of that. You know, it could be 25, could be 50% of that pie, as long as a lot of other technologies come along as well. So I think that there's incredible upside and great opportunities for people to start businesses, and particularly in the solar space, but all over clean tech.
So unlike Jonathan's company, where he was mostly going against a lot of big players in the water space, you're going against actually two sets. One is 50 different startups. I'm just, you know, 40, 50 different startups that are about the same stage, many of them about the same stage, some of them earlier, some of them a little later. But you're also going up against BP and Shell and Sharp and Kyocera and several other companies, big multinationals. How does that factor into just starting a business when you've got those kinds of players?
Yeah. Well, a couple of thoughts. First off, people may not know this, but solar is a $12.5 billion industry. Last year it was I had sort of an aha moment. My partner, Bill Gross, helped create the idea of paid search with a company called Overture that he started 7 or 8 years ago. And we talk a lot about paid search and internet-based advertising marketplaces and Google. We're sort of obsessed about Google like a lot of people in technology. And I said, Bill, I just read the other day that internet advertising, the entire internet advertising industry last year was $12 billion. And last year, solar was 12.5. Is that possible? Is it correct? I mean, maybe the growth or the margin numbers are different or something. The margin numbers are different, but they're both growing at about 35% per year. And solar has been growing at 35% per year for 15 years. So it is now the fastest growing segment of the energy industry and has been really for 10 years running. And it's now larger than all of internet advertising, all of Google's and Yahoo's and everybody else's marketplace. And yet, quick aside, if you take the market caps of every single solar company out there, it doesn't even come close to the market cap of one of those, of a Yahoo or a Google. So, sorry, I'm going off topic a little bit. But
okay, well, let me ask you a question of the audience first. Also, I meant to do this earlier. How many of you in this room would describe yourself as either an eco-entrepreneur of some sort or thinking of starting a business that has some environmental social benefit?
Oh, great.
Just curious, any of you from the, just a few, shout them out, what, just the types of business, the types of sectors? Anybody want to volunteer?
I'm working for a large corporation back in South Africa. As a developer to the second beverage industry, beverage company in the world, particularly around alcohol, on Miller Brewing in the U.S. But my role there is basically on the sustainable development directive. And what we're doing is we're developing small businesses around the eco market, particularly in the communities that we operate, around water and around energy. Particular of interest to us is the whole mix around solar, and we think it's amazing that Africa hasn't tapped into it, but we know the issue why. So what we're trying to do is not necessarily as if the mill as a whole, but we're developing small micro businesses in order to actually get those communities on the upside.
So small businesses in solar and water, well, I guess there's no connection here. So no, others, yes?
I'm an investor in metal-free dyes and refillable detergent.
The dyes for what kinds of applications?
All kinds of applications.
Textiles?
Including solar energy. It's the thing is the paint, any metamerism dyes, based on a technology the Mayans invented 1,200 years ago.
Wow.
I invested in and helped found Horizon Organic, which is the largest organic dairy company.
Yeah.
And I'm currently starting up an offshore aquaculture business in Hawaii.
Raising
open ocean farming fish.
After this panel, we're going to have everybody else
I
come
know,
up
really.
Here.
I work for McGraw-Hill, and we're starting a new magazine called Green Source,
right, I know.
Which is about sustainability for the it's directed to architects.
With the U.S. Green Building Council.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Well, mine is slightly different, which is housing within the humanitarian reconstruction movement.
Is it for-profit?
It's going to be both.
Okay. Hybrid. Yeah.
Well, I chair a nonprofit which decided to spend some money, some of its accumulated undivided profits, which it has, on distributing a product that cleans water in developing countries, and now we are doing that plus distributing Procter & Gamble product that does the same thing.
Pure, that little the packet?
Pure,
yeah.
Is the Procter & Gamble
product.
Right. But the idea was that we had some resources from other operations, and we shared the same attitude as Mr. Greenblatt on the water problem.
Great. Well, there's one more. You're right there.
Yeah, I'm Global Homes with an Umposi. And so these are homes for under 5,000 homes.
Wow.
All green, all sustainable.
Well, first of all, I mean, what an incredible group here. Hats off to all of you for doing all this. But what's interesting, I mean, the variety, you've got manufacturing processes, dyes, several around water, housing, about three of housing. And
I have an environmental communications company, and it's at this point non-profit, but obviously it's more to rebrand the environmental movement, period, that it, I think it, you know, needs a facelift, and so really branding air, land, and water, and creating an environmental action spots that go over grist.org, that's
yeah.
And then having an attendant website that if you like what you, you know, if you are inspired from it, then you can do something about it.
So we're not only going from the manufacturing sector, but now in the service sector as well. Let me ask a question, because it sort of came up, and I think this is for more for you, Jonathan. Why did you do this as a for-profit? Why not? It seems that it's inherently a non-profit kind of thing, and I think there's some... but the part of the context for this now is I know a lot of eco-entrepreneurs who are looking at this. Is this for-profit? Is this non-profit? Is it a hybrid kind of model, which I think Cameron is doing? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you think about those?
So it's a good question. So let me explain. I want to actually say one thing. What was your name again? I think what Mark just mentioned about rebranding the environment is really critically important. I remember when we were trying to bring Ethos to investors, I had people tell us, people who'd seen companies like Horizon Organic do wonderful things, that we didn't look green enough, that we looked too premium, that we looked too slick, that we looked too sophisticated to be socially responsible. And I think, and I thought, and I still think, that those people are nuts. Because I think that the consuming public today isn't just, you know, who it was 20 or 30 years ago that were the people going to the local organic co-ops, if you will. Green, if you will, has been mainstreamed. I'm not going to say it's the new black. But people don't want to trade off. They want to buy a bottle of Ethos water. I know they're doing good for the world. But at the same time, it better look as good as that bottle of Fiji, right? So I think it's really important. And as we see the evolution of premium brands, we know that the market is maturing, and it's here. With respect to your question, we actually set up initially Ethos Water as a for-profit business, and we set up a nonprofit called Ethos International. We wanted to channel the money that we made, the profits through the nonprofit, and distribute it to different NGOs that were working around the world. We wanted to have controls, have our own nonprofit make those distributions. But we set up the business as a for-profit because we weren't competing with Save the Children, or Mercy Corps, or WaterAid. Those groups have their competences. We were competing with Fiji, and Evian, and Aquafina, and Dasani. And so we had to be able to hire brand managers from P&G or Kraft, right? We had to be able to hire salespeople from Coke and Pepsi and pay them the kind of salaries and give them the kind of equity, let alone for our investors who would demand that kind of equity to make the business work. So for us, we knew that as a nonprofit, we could never give the rewards to the investors, to the vendors, to the employees that we needed to succeed.
I want to get to questions in just a minute, but I'm going to ask one or two more. You're 4 or 5 years older and wiser than you were back when you were getting some of this started, and as you've looked at the investor marketplace, you talked about the socially responsible or the social angels. There is this growing core of angel investors who are, you know, specifically looking for these kinds of things. Do you see any difference in the attitudes now? Is that changing at all in terms of how they look at environment, how they look at energy, at markets like the ones you're talking about? Would you go in with a different kind of message now because of that than you did back then?
Yeah, I mean, we've gone from, preschool to secondary education level, at least, in the realm of, you know, what education is necessary for investors. I mean, frankly, I think there are some in this room who have an extraordinarily sophisticated level of knowledge about the different marketplaces, and they are the ones who are ahead, and they're looking at very cutting-edge things like aquaculture and other things, and different aspects of coal, et cetera, that people wouldn't have even pondered trying to understand 5 years ago. But I think most people, honestly, really are still coming up the curve. But 5 years ago, it was, you know, it was 1,000 whys before you got to the what. And now I think, especially around sort of played out areas like solar and a couple of other fuel cell areas, you're getting enough domain expertise that people are making savvy investments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with Andrew. I think the sector has matured. So I wouldn't define us as an eco business. I mean, this is not environmentally friendly. What I would say is we're endeavor to be sort of a socially responsible, social purpose business. In our future, we thought wasn't this. This was just the best way to be introduced to consumers. We thought the future were things like filters. So you'd have a filter in your home, so you'd be drinking just like we do at our house. You'd be drinking from the tap, right? But that would be an Ethos water filter. And every time you would use it or every time you would buy it, money would go to the cause. In any event, I think that we need real capital markets for this field to truly blossom. And I think the fact that the venture community has gotten on board is great. The fact that at business schools across the country, they're now teaching this is great. But we still have to see things like the evolution of financial instruments, the evolution of more of the sort of intermediaries like accounting firms and law firms and advertising firms that understand this for the market to truly, you know.
But let's just add one thing to that too, which is that when we started Big Step in 96, we set aside 1% of our equity for doing good, you know, doing great things for the planet, and actually put it into a nonprofit that was set up by some venture capitalists. And it was a nice thing to do. Unfortunately, it wasn't a massive pot when we were done. Google did a similar thing, and Google knocked it out of the park.
Right.
So there's a environmentally focused group of people, but I think not, as you're pointing out, really not an environmental company, but a socially responsible company. And because they do that, Silicon Valley, I mean, from investors to new entrepreneurs, suddenly it's blessed. Everybody can do that, and everybody can get away with that, right? And I think a lot of entrepreneurs have wanted to do that, but they've sort of hesitated because there's a standard template you get from your law firm to do a venture financing. And now that template could include the Google clause,
right,
and it can be accepted. So I think, you know, there's incredible leadership that's not just coming from entrepreneurial, environmental kind of things.
One more question, and we'll go to all these. I see the hands are shooting up. Almost every day, I get a call, an email, something, sort of accosted in the street, with somebody who wants to start a business or work for either a socially responsible or a clean tech startup, and they all have some version of this question, you know, sort of, what do I do? How do I get started? How do I get into this? Sometimes if they're in school, it's what do I study? Different. You must get deluged with those kinds of things. I know if I'm getting those, you're getting inundated. How do you help? What's sort of the sage wisdom that you guys now have, having both been successes in both the non-environmental world and now in the environmental clean tech world, that you give them that says, you know, where do I look? How do I think about this? Where do I start?
I'll give you my quick take on it, but it's far from sage wisdom. When I hear from MBAs or other people that they want to join like the, and I heard this a lot when I was at Starbucks, the corporate social responsibility group, they want to do CSR. Have you all heard that term before? Sort of the business nomenclature for the do-good department. What I tell them is the last place you want to go is the CSR group. You should do what you're good at, because we will change the world when we incorporate sustainability or regenerative strategies into finance, when maybe it'll be like a Google effect, when the financial statement has an additional sort of thing at the bottom line which talks about the social return on investment, maybe not the income statement, but when the financial reporting includes an SROI analysis, or when the operations group has someone in there who's just looking to drive green efficiencies into the manufacturing processes. So if you really want to create change, do what you're good at and incorporate sustainability into that, into your skill set.
Yeah, we talked about this last night, that the environment is way too important to be left to the environmental department.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, as Lorraine was saying from GE, you know, part of the magic that will come out of what they're doing is they are just embedding across that entire company, into every single piece, those people. And the same thing is happening at Walmart, too, and at least I believe that. And I think those are where you see the transformational changes. I often talk to people, do you want to join a startup or do you want to join a large company? And that's usually the first break, because there's a big difference there. And it reminds me of a conversation I had 6 years ago with a good friend, fellow entrepreneur from the Valley, and we were both basically out of work trying to figure out what do we do next. He was very concerned about the environment, as was I, and we were talking about this coming wave, and he agreed. You know, he's a staunch Republican, big environmentalist, and his sort of take was, hey, this is going to happen. It's just a matter of, is it going to happen in 2 years or 10 years? So we looked at it as the next wave coming, and our sort of conclusion was, okay, you can either jump in and tread water while you're waiting for that wave to come, maybe even help create it a little bit, or you can sit on the beach longer and sort of, when it comes, you'll be out there a little bit later. You might not have as good a ride, but at least, you know, you'll be alive. And so we took different paths, and he decided to take more on the beach path, and I took a path of treading water. And that's important to me because it's sort of a stark contrast of treading water is hard and can be painful, but when I speak at business schools and, you know, you see this transformation of packed halls of people saying they want to get into the space, I try and rattle people and explain it's going to be a long, hard haul. But if you really want that, just dive in and get going. And I think, actually, I think startups are the best place to do that, because to answer, finally answer your earlier question, I think the large companies, and this is, I think, really a big part of why Starbucks took on Ethos, that large companies do suffer from, Clay Christensen issues around innovators' dilemmas, and they do have a tough time turning supertankers. And in certain places, not in centralized utility-based systems like wind power, but in decentralized like solar, or maybe even in water with a purpose, you actually can get way ahead of them. And so if you're willing to take all those risks and you can afford to take risks for a couple of years, I tell people to just dive in.
So being small and adaptive can pay off against the big players.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we got about 40 minutes and a lot of really interesting, talented people in this room, so let's get into the questions. Tom.
I would second what you said about, I guess what I'm saying is I would endorse your being a for-profit. What we found at Horizon, one of the primary reasons that Horizon succeeded was because we made a lot of money. Companies yeah. very profitable. Everybody down the chain making money. Our first challenge in that business, we felt there was a latent market out there for the product, but our challenge was to convince farmers to convert from conventional to organic agriculture, because without organic feed, we couldn't feed our cows, without our cows, we couldn't feed. And we had to show them that it was profitable for them to do that. So, you know, when you're talking about how would you suggest people enter into the marketplace, I would opt that the future of sustainable businesses is they must be profitable. And what you need to focus on is how you convince investors that the risk is mitigated because they are part of a maxi trend. And one of the things when we put Horizon together was we actually had a flawed assumption. Our assumption was that people would buy our product because it was good for them.
Right.
And we could convince them that organic milk was better for them than right. conventional milk. But we found out that after we were going for a year, we did a consumer test, and we found out that only half the people were buying it for that reason. Mm-hmm. And the other half were buying it because it was good for the earth. Mm-hmm. And people vote with their pocketbooks, and people will pay more to show what they believe in. And so I don't know how you can quantify that, but...
Because they just want to do something, and that's what...
Exactly. The reason that they'll buy your product, maybe instead of that product, is because they feel better about doing it. And that's very, very real. And so the question is, how do you incorporate that into business plans so that it converts into financial equations that will allow the angel/venture people to invest right. in your company?
Can I just add another litmus test to that right on top of that? I mean, I think the other piece is there's sort of this optimism message, which is, you shouldn't be, a lot of people here have said in different panels that we need to do less, we need to conserve, we need to drive smaller cars. And I think conservation is great, but I think the opposite is true. We don't necessarily need to turn up the thermostats or down in the summer. I think you can have your cake and eat it too. And I think that the litmus test is it better?
Right.
And your product was better. I mean, it was better for the earth, but it also tastes better. It's actually just better. And I think when we look at, you know, solar, and we look at a lot of different energy pieces, there are some pieces where you're actually selling compromise. And I think that that's a, you know, colossal business failure. And so that would also further the belief that, for the most part, these things should be for-profit endeavors, because it forces you to prove that you have something better. And when you do, you'll just win in the marketplace.
Tom, I'm sorry.
I just want to add to that, because I think you're so right. We found that consumers ask themselves a question, unconsciously perhaps, but with almost every product that they buy, including Ethos, what's in it for me? And so rare was the consumer who bought Ethos because they thought it saved the world. But they bought it because it made them feel like they were doing something. And when you can create businesses that tap that, I don't care whether it's consumer businesses or business-oriented strategies, that tap that innate innate desire to do something. And you can activate that spirit that's within all of us, particularly within what we call the millennial generation. The most frequently asked question we get from consumers is, what more can I do? Which is great.
Drink more water.
Of course.
You know, Tom brought up an interesting point, too, also in the business plan side of things, which I think is also a big challenge for a lot of eco-entrepreneurs, which is, how do you state the case for how big the market is? I mean, everybody quotes LOHAS data and cultural creatives, and you rolled your eyes, and I always roll my eyes when I hear those numbers,
silly.
Too, because I don't think, you know, there's the green gauge from Roper Starch and a bunch of other...
Gazillion was the last number that
gazillion, yeah. It's about a gazillion consumers who are ready, willing, and able to buy better, greener products. But, of course, you know, shopping carts tend to look much like they always have. And so there is some disconnect between that. But so if you're trying to... If you have a business plan for a market that hasn't fully formed yet, how do you state that?
I'm a former big consumer products company CEO, and I'll tell you how. You offer the retailers in the middle more margin.
Yeah.
I mean, fundamentally, you know, people don't recognize this, but the single thing that will make the organic food movement long-term, and I mean outside of dairy, I mean broadly, is that it's finally a way to return some profit to the food industry. And if you sit down with Walmart, you know, the reason Walmart's very interested in these categories is because this is a chance for them to earn more penny profit on everything that they sell. And if you build that into your business structure from the beginning, there's something in it for everybody. You're right, what's in it for the consumer at the end. But if there's something in for the people who are responsible for delivering this benefit to consumers, you will fly.
What was your name?
Lily. John.
John. I mean, John is so right. Many people say to me, you know, well, if you really cared about saving the world, which, you know, that's a generous appraisal of me, but if you really cared about saving the world, you'd make this 99 cents a bottle. You'd make this the same price as the cheapest bottles in the store.
How much is it?
Then everyone could buy it.
What does it sell for?
Quite the contrary. It sells in Starbucks for $1.80. We launch at Whole Foods at $2.50.
Wow.
Of course, we didn't set those prices, but the consumer doesn't cut you any slack. They don't understand that. They assume if they buy something on the shelf and it's $2, it's my fault, the manufacturer.
Yeah.
But we had to charge premium prices, not only because premium prices meant we had a little more wiggle room and we could compete with the Nestle's and the Pepsi's, but more importantly, we could give margin to retailers.
Prices are confirming this
day. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And the retailer would believe, because he knew as a vendor, he would make more for every unit that he sold. That's the only reason he put our product on the shelf, not because he cared about children in Ethiopia or anywhere else.
We're launching a low-cost alternative to photovoltaic panels, and it's a tracking concentrator. It moves and tracks the sun over the course of the day and generates power at a lower cost. It's a great idea, but it has moving parts. And so we've been very anxious about introducing this product into the marketplace of systems integrators, those middlemen. And we've been very nervous about how they would receive this and maybe say, well, why don't you let it run for 3 years, which is the payback period, and then we'll believe you. So, again, total opposite. They saw an opportunity to set their own price, and if solar were selling today at $7.50 and our product would allow it to be sold at $4.50, it's going to be sold at $7.25 or $7.35 or $7.45. They're going to go up as high as they can, and they're going to make a killing on it, at least in the early period. So, you know, we learned a great lesson there on exactly that piece.
Yeah.
I don't know. Also, one thing I just wanted to piggyback on your comment is that the whole idea, I also work in consumer products, but the whole idea of category management and really owned by the retailer, they're watching their real estate very carefully. So if this product is giving them more money, it's going to get premium shelf space, eye level, end of aisle displays, yada, yada.
Yeah. So that's what a friend of mine who was for a brief time the chief marketing officer at Kmart described that retail today, at least in the big box stores, is really, when you look at it, a merger between an IT company and a real estate department.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on.
Yeah, where do you? This is sourced in volcanoes in Fiji. Where is that?
Yeah. So we believe in the. I'm not going to. I don't want to comment on where that's sourced or how it's sourced because I'm not expert in it. First of all, the one thing I will tell you is that almost all the potable water, unless there's some scare or something happens or the water is affected by some contaminant, your tap water is fine. It's fine. The issue is often the lead pipes in which the tap water sits. That can be the problem. But filters on your tap water will make your water just fine. And if you drink 8 glasses of water a day, I think 8 8-ounce glasses or something like that, depending on your weight, you'll be healthy. You know, so you don't have to drink water from some exotic locale for it to be good for you. Again, I said earlier, bottled water is not great. It is not terrific that this is in a plastic PET container. I wish, you know, we've looked at some of the biodegradables applications that are out there. There's something called PLA, which is developed by Cargill Dow. It's a corn-based resin, a biodegradable resin. Sounds wonderful until you think about bottled water sitting in your car and it's 100 degrees outside because it's the summer in Aspen or in Southern California, and your bottle at 110 degrees starts to break down, right? So it gets squishy in your hands, or you see particles in the water, right? And you think about creating a supply chain of refrigerated trucks. That's not so great. But so to answer your question, what's different about our water? I think there's two fundamental differences.
Then the tap.
Well, our water is a natural spring water. We believe in the idea of local sourcing. We try to get the water from sustainable natural springs that aren't at risk of depletion, and we do mineralogical studies to confirm that, number one. And number two, natural springs that are close to the markets that we serve. We try to minimize the transport of the water to the customers, which happens to give us better economics than shipping your water from across the planet, the French Alps or Iceland or wherever you get it from. And happens to be more environmentally sound, because the fossil fuels you need to move water across the planet are horrifying. So we believe in local sourcing. We have a source in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and we have a for the West Coast. We have a source in the Poconos to serve the East Coast, and we'll have additional sources that come online as we grow through the United States and as we launch in Europe next year. So all locally sourced.
Yeah, sir.
Yes, back to the water. You mentioned earlier that before your sale to Starbucks, you put the 50%, correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah,
profits aside. I'm not too sure about that. Then when you made the sale, now it's 5 cents a bottle.
Yep.
How much money are we talking to tell you about, and what does the Starbucks Foundation do with that?
So just to, I'm glad you asked the question, because to dive a little deeper, we did the math on it. You know, Peter and I are both MBAs and figured out the numbers. If we reached profitability, which we hadn't done yet, based on our size and the volume we would achieve, we would have been doing about 2.4 to 2.5 cents a unit. That would have been our profits had we reached profitability. However, we were unprofitable. What we did was we took money out of our marketing budget, if you will, and started making contributions to different NGOs. Now, we call them investments because we didn't think of ourselves as a traditional nonprofit. We made these NGOs sign grant agreements, so we would allocate the funds over time, like in quarterly payments, if you will. Give them, let's say, a $50,000 grant, like we did a program with UNICEF. We brought clean water to the slums in Nairobi, Kenya. They got the first installment of $12,500, right? And then they had to give us reporting. We made them agree to a set of metrics. They had to give us photographs. We wanted stories from the children whose lives we were impacting as we built water storage tanks and whatnot at these orphanages and these other homes for orphan children. That was really important because we didn't just want to give them the money and then, you know, good luck. We wanted to give them the money, and we would continue to give it to them only on the basis of reporting. So we had made on our own about $100,000 worth of commitments, and of that, probably about $30,000 had gone out to different NGOs working in places like Honduras, Ethiopia, Kenya, India, Bangladesh, so all over the world. After Starbucks bought our company, we shut down that nonprofit that we had set up. We created the Ethos Water Fund within the Starbucks Foundation. And that Ethos Water Fund now does what we used to do, just at a much larger scale. And we'll be donating probably we'll donate at least 10 to 12 million over the next 4 years. And the numbers will grow astronomical, continue to just grow really, really well. So there'll be a lot of funds going to the cause.
That's great.
Tom, do you have a question?
You know, I think the thing that for us was and is difficult to do is to separate the business aspect of all this from the heartstrings, emotional, do-gooder aspect. And without being cynical, I can tell you that if you can't get the business right, the rest of it collapses, and you never have the opportunity to do it. And the thing that turned my light on was when we first started going to the organic food show, you know, 1992, it was a bunch of hippies in tie-dye shirts that were pretty much just talking about food products. And the last time I went, which is the year we sold the company, it was Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and all the big names were there because it's a real business. And you've got to, it makes you feel really good to participate in a business that people really like. For years and years, and I still have businesses where I build warehouses, you know, and they're very profitable business, great business, but, you know, I wouldn't like my legacy, my kids to be in these warehouses that your dad built. But things like this make you feel really good about what you do. But you got to get the business side of it right. And if you don't, it will not be sustainable.
Picking up on that, find that because of the business that you're in helps you to attract talent? Attracting talent is a challenge, particularly for startups, people who are you know, going to work for a company that doesn't yet have a future necessarily, at least a solid one. Does that help in some way? Did having a mission of some sort that, or even if it's, in your case, it's not a mission company, but it's making a renewable energy product?
It's been transformative. I mean, it reminds me of the height of the bubble of the internet, except that you get people, you know, when we were hiring the internet period, we were hiring very quickly, and we were looking for, obviously, capabilities, but we were also looking for energy and passion. And you would often find people, you could find, you'd have to hunt when talent was tight, but you'd find people with energizing and energy capabilities and execution capabilities, but you would always miss that passion. And I found over 6 years that those were often the people that didn't work out. And now you have people walking in the door who are just exploding with passion. And so all, you know, then you just sort of filter on those other criteria, particularly execution capability.
And they have talent as well as passion?
Well, not all of them, I mean, yeah, to be sure. But you get an incredible base support. And the thing that I think people most often overlook in recruiting is suddenly front and center. So you can almost check it off. And I think it helps create a, you know, very powerful team environment.
Well, let's look at your company particularly, because you're hiring a lot of engineers, for example, people out of Caltech, which is just down the street from you guys. How much does that crowd, the engineering crowd coming out of the major institutions, care about these kinds of things?
You know, with us, it's definitely been mixed. We have now, in the beginning, I would say half of our core engineering team didn't care at all. And then they actually, a lot of them have sort of converted and gotten very, very excited about what they're doing day to day. But we recently, you know, there's a dark side to this, too. We recently recruited a head of engineering, and we scoured the planet and, you know, used the greatest recruiters in the world, you know, had our venture capitalists out hunting. And we actually interviewed a lot of people who had been in the energy space for decades. And what we found, actually, was that there was a lot of talent missing there. And so it's interesting to see, particularly, and I think some of that is because some of those early companies and efforts were lab-based, and they weren't based on economic incentives for those individuals. So now that you put great economic incentives in place, we have found people crossing over from different industries. And you do lose some of the depth, but you get extraordinarily motivated people. So, you know, we're finding passion in all different ways, not just, you know, the environment.
Peter, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we had a really hard time hiring good people. It was very difficult. We were a beverage company. We found lots of beverage people with skills who couldn't give a flying hoot about the cause, just didn't care at all. Then we found people who were passionate about the cause but had absolutely no business skills to contribute. So I think it was really hard. I have a lot of faith, though, in the millennials, again, in these young people, because I think across the board, the response that we got from young people is they want to go work for companies that are doing some good on the planet. It's not enough just to make money anymore. And that is very encouraging for all of us.
Yes.
You know, I think it's great what you're doing, but with all due respect, I think that we have a real problem in terms of what's going on in terms of the whole reduce, reuse, recycle mentality. Because I think even with the millennials, like, again, we could probably, all of us here, fill a baby landfill with all the changing water that we've all consumed this week. And it just really scares me. And I mean, the statistics that I've read that water is already, I think, surpass carbonated beverages, and I know that category is way down. And I just wonder, I mean, to anyone, you know, like, what are these groups doing? What are we doing to have that reduced part of the equation drilled into people's heads? And I mean, you look around, people don't think about it. It's just like, oh, it just goes somewhere. And I've also heard statistically from the packaging people that I work with that even if we were to recycle every bottle that we use, it costs more in the fossil fuels, again, to recycle it than to, what? Exactly. Then, so yeah. She's like, oh, don't even really bother because, and so therefore, we, for some of the products that I've launched, we were recommended to use glass.
But then shipping costs are much higher, the fuel costs associated
exactly,
with it.
That was
so that sort of begs the question, how good is good enough, you know, if you're going to be a social or eco product? Is there, I mean, how do you decide that?
I mean, we decided to be bad at first and to try to go good, right? Again, I think this package ain't great for all the reasons you were describing, among others. Again, I think bottled water is not terrific to start with. But my hope would be that as our, like for us, as our brand would grow, developed that emotion to consumers, we could launch a glass package. We could launch a 5-gallon package to sit in the office cooler or in your house and filters and whatnot. So I think how good is good enough. We were starting with this and hoped we would do better. You know, I can't comment on the technical aspects of recycling as you're relating to it, but I think every company has to start somewhere to try to do the best that you can. Right.
The last time I researched it was in college, but I don't know up to date what's going on.
Yeah. Andrew?
I think some people in the audience are going to have something to add to this for sure. But just quickly, Bill McDonough has this concept of intention, and it's a mimicked in the U.S. Green Building Council as well, of just sort of get certified. I think you have to start, and you have to go in, and you have to try. And I had this great moment in Bentonville, Arkansas, talking to a little retail company there who was doing sustainability. And so I pulled one of the product managers aside, and I said, well, why are you doing it? I mean, really, why are you doing this? Is this because your boss told you? Is this because it's built into the comp structure? He said, no, I was trained about packaging and the impacts of it, and so I figured out that if I removed this plastic bag and used recycled cardboard on the outside of a T-shirt, because it doesn't need a bag because we move them so quickly, they don't need to be sealed, I could save the company, and it was, $5 million, and I could save six forests, and the sort of the lights went off, and this was their aha. So I do actually think that these are complex ecosystems, but I do think that the reduce mentality, if correctly implemented at those choke points in the supply chains and other places, people could start using, corn-based bottles, et cetera, you're going to see it happen. So getting to the right people is a big piece. But then the other piece is that in our product, we're doing cradle to cradle. We are looking very carefully at the lease model, just like interface with the carpets, but our ability to give the product out and then take it back and reclaim it. And one of the reasons is because our product is 90% aluminum, and that aluminum will last forever, and we can actually reuse some of the parts. And so we're working with aluminum companies and others to try and make sure that when we design it, we're not polluting it so it can be reclaimed and reused. And I think at a corporate level, I think there's a lot you can do. You just have to educate around the system.
I would almost say as a homework assignment from this panel, everyone who hasn't done so should read Will McDonough's Cradle to Cradle. If you haven't read it, it is one of the most powerful and inspiring books you will read. I don't know if it's in the bookstore over there or not, but it's well worth your read if you care about these issues.
Okay, we got Mike and then Andrew.
Psychologically, it's getting much worse, and I'll just give you a case in point. I was in Fiji, and one of my pet peeves is Fiji water. And the reason is because it's a bottle, plastic bottle that lasts 400 years. And so we went out and spent a lot of money on a filtration, very sophisticated filtration system. But psychologically, to get our guests to drink water that was actually cleaner, and to use it as opposed to using a bottle of water was really, really difficult. And we have reduced it. We've now used Fiji water for our wastewater filtration system, one of the things we've been able to do with plastic bottles. But it is, from a psychological standpoint, it is really difficult the more we use and drink recycled bottles. In all of our resorts, I wish I could say I could get away from it. The number one thing in all of our mini bars is bottled water. That's what everybody wants. They don't want to drink Coke. They don't want to drink Pepsi. They want bottled water.
I've seen that. It's up to $8.
Did you comment on that?
And yeah.
Yeah. Andrew?
So I run a company that does green business strategy mostly for large enterprises, but we're also working now with some smaller entrepreneurs. And my question is a very like rubber hits the road one, really for Jonathan. Do you think that we might be in a short window where there's this opportunity for entrepreneurs, eco-entrepreneurs, to do businesses like Ethos, but then in 5 years that window could close because effectively any big company will be able to do a green product line because they'll recognize your success, Horizon success, Whole Foods success, etc. And particularly on the consumer side, less so the B2B side and energy, where you have real technology innovations. But it struck me as from a standpoint of a venture capitalist looking at what's a defensible asset.
Right.
There really isn't one.
Well.
Right? Or how do we think about green entrepreneurship going forward? Are we in this kind of window, potentially not to be negative about it, biggest companies in the world, the GEs and Walmarts and P&Gs, are we potentially in a little window here where those the 10 people in this room who have, you know, green business ideas better run with them now? Because essentially, not that it's going to become commodified, but that any big business will be able to, they will launch into green markets without any hesitation.
I will give you my responses, and I think, again, some other people in the room may also have responses. I think large multinational corporations or big companies are, to use an analogy that was made before, they're like battleships or tankers. It's very difficult to turn them. And they almost are, they are constitutionally incapable of true innovation. What they do is they often outsource their product development. And they will acquire innovative ideas, whether it's Dean buying, I think it was Dean who bought Horizon, or Starbucks who buys Ethos, because they are so risk-averse and so driven to EPS, they can't take the risks that they need to. So I think that there will always be opportunities for innovative startups that are pioneering developing these new ideas, because the big companies simply can't move enough because the incentives aren't aligned effectively for them early on. I think the second thing that should give everyone hope is the number one ingredient in Ethos. I tell you, we did market research after we were acquired because we couldn't afford it to do it once before. And we said to consumers, what is it that's most important to you about this package and this bottle? What is it that's most important? And we broke it down to all its components. The most important thing, very surprising to me, I don't know if any of you have seen this before in Starbucks, if you have ever bothered to look at it for more than half a second, but it was that little letter from me and Pete, the founders. It says the Ethos story. We began with a simple idea. Let's create a bottled water and help children get clean water, blah, blah, blah. It was the authenticity that people respond to. And authenticity is something that comes only from the heart. And I think that Fortune 500s or Fortune 100s, when they're trying to talk to the consumers, have a very difficult time duplicating and creating authenticity.
Yeah.
But now others may disagree with that. So.
Well,
same way that retailing is becoming a combination of a real estate department, you know, finding that channel and being able to put those products through them is going to be the expertise of large companies.
I would just say, notice, because the next time a Jonathan Greenblatt shows up with a product like Ethos, the next market, Coca-Cola could replicate that in a minute and say, we're going to make twice as much product.
Look at the Ask a Web 2.0 entrepreneur. Or Ask a VC. I mean, right now, the hottest space in Silicon Valley venture capital is not clean tech, it's Web 2.0. And this is just literally, some of the people are just reinventing old businesses that were good ideas then, but there wasn't enough broadband penetration. Now they're great ideas. Microsoft, IBM, others should all be jumping up and doing that, and they're not doing it. So, I mean, we're even seeing history repeat itself that quickly. And, you know, another piece, by the way, is don't underestimate the power of a small group of people. I mean, there's the Gandhi quote, you know, don't underestimate the ability of one person to change the world, because, in fact, that's the only thing that ever has it. Maybe Virginia Woolf. Thank you, Margaret Mead. And I'm sure I completely...
This is the tough audience to pull a quote like that.
And I completely hacked...
Yeah,
Gandhi had... And I hacked it as well. But I mean, look, we've got 35 engineers working on breakthrough solar technology. I don't believe GE or any other company in the United States, Sharp maybe is an exception, has an R&D group that large. So with a small amount of money and a small group of people, you can actually, you know, and we may not be as efficient in some ways or have as much depth as some of those R&D organizations, but we really do have a lot of people working on it. And I think other entrepreneurs can take a similar approach.
I think, just to add on to that, I think almost every other sector it's not just in green products. It has started off, the small companies do the innovation, the big companies commercialize them.
Yeah.
We've seen that in lots of different technologies. I think we're going to see that in things like plug-in hybrids, where a lot of smaller companies are going to come in and the big guys are going to say, oh, grid, let's do that too. So this is just, I think, part of a natural progression of what's going on. We have one question over here, and then you.
The question is rather sharing some of our own experiences, obviously coming from a developing country. I agree about the backhaul concept around the big tank. I work for an organization that's a big tank, and
trying to be innovative and actually bringing some of the ideas that we believe can help our company to actually differentiate itself as a good corporate citizen, that you actually change the hearts and minds of people that just think volume in terms of beer, they actually don't see the other side of the coin. But what we have actually tried to do is to basically look and tap into some of the social issues that we have on the ground. South Africa only became independent a few years ago, and part of government's agenda is around how do you actually transfer some of the economic base to those who are previously disenfranchised. So what we try to do to tap into, for example, around energy, is to basically develop small businesses and become suppliers to this big tank that I actually work for. And what we're doing, for example, around solar, is to look at it from a perspective where we basically move away from coal-based electricity. We can claim the carbon credits for those communities, and then they can benefit as a spin-off business. On water, what we do, we've got effluent treatment plants. The wastewater effluent that we have, we're actually treating it directly and provide water for communities for agricultural purposes. So my question really is around to say, okay, particularly for you, Jonathan, you develop a business around water, and haven't you sold yourself short by selling the brand to Starbucks? What differentiated you, in my view, was that, you know, this was different, it wasn't part of those big giants.
Right.
But now it's a brand that's actually owned by Starbucks, in fact. And obviously, leading to that was again around the, I've missed the point, but if we can just address that. You know, the point I was going to ask was also to say, the businesses of the future, in my view, should be really looking at getting people out of poverty by actually tapping into the broader eco market that you're actually talking about, that we can scale up, that people actually have jobs around the areas that you're looking at, particularly breaking them out of the social side.
So to respond to the question about, like, why did you sell and wasn't it sort of selling yourself short? And I can tell you that personally, I mean, I have been on the receiving end of a lot of criticism from folks for that reason. They say, wow, you're a sellout. there were 40 million reasons why we did this deal. That's the number of people who walk through Starbucks every week. The economics of the beverage industry in the United States are such that there are a couple, it's really it's concentrated market with Coke, Pepsi, and Nestle pushing those trucks. And if you're not on one of those trucks, you don't get the space on the shelves, it's very difficult to get to market. Starbucks was sort of an alternative way to build the brand very effectively. And we were sort of a mission with the brand. That's how we started this thing, to help children get clean water. It's the opportunity to get our brand in front of 40 million people a week, to get Starbucks to agree to commit to our financial business model relative to contributions for every unit sold, and to educate all those people. That's why we did it. We weren't setting out to build the biggest bottled water company in the world. We were setting out to change the world and to do that by reaching consumers, and Starbucks gave us the best platform.
My question is probably for Andrew and perhaps Joel. In the United States, we have 22 states and the District of Columbia who have set up renewable portfolio standards that force renewable energy solutions into the marketplace and the trading of renewable energy certificates and that sort of thing. Where these rules are not encumbered by the legislatures as to sort of pre-predict the solutions, they tend to go to wind and not solar. My question is that something about the short-run economics or that is going to change in the long run? How do you see these equations now and in the future?
Yeah. Renewable portfolio standards around the country and around the world mandate utilities to purchase a certain amount, a certain percentage of their power from renewable sources. And as you're pointing out, some have set aside for solar, but most don't. And yet we're still seeing, so there's sort of a buying hierarchy. Actually, it's geothermal and other things first, and then wind, and there's sort of a pyramid, and solar is the most expensive. But at a certain point, you actually start to exhaust wind in California, for example. So now utilities are looking at large-scale solar buys, even though it's more expensive. They sort of take a portfolio approach, and they blend those costs. But the simple answer is solar is too expensive today by a long shot. California is sort of the perfect storm market because we have very high commercial utility costs. We have a lot of sun, and we've also got great government subsidies. And without those subsidies, the economics just evaporate. And so I'm hopeful that it's a very short-term problem, and I'm hoping that our product, which is releasing next year, will be part of that solution. But as Joel's pointed out, there are dozens of companies trying to attack that marketplace and get that cost down. And that's really, that's the only issue. There are intermittency issues, for example, at night when there's no sun. But all those are mitigatable with technology, just as is the case with wind. The only issue is cost, and there are plenty of great reasons why that cost will go down very quickly in the next 5 to 10 years.
And one of the things that's going to happen is you're going to be starting to see utility-scale solar farms that use concentrators and tracking devices and a number of things that are going to bring it to much more scalable. But there's a number of structural issues, not the least of which is a shortage of silicon, which is keeping prices. It right now, solar should be coming down in price as it's going up dramatically.
I'll tell you this. It is much, much better than any other power source except nuclear and possibly wind.
Okay. Let's take one last question, and then we'll wrap up.
Okay, hi. I sort of came to this seminar today with a thesis in mind. I'm an individual entrepreneur with an idea that's not formed enough to put out there in a room of this level of sophistication in these issues. That said, the thesis that I came with, I want to throw it out and let you respond to it because I think it really is a question in the end. My thesis is that we've sort of reached a tipping point societally and as a culture where issues about responsibility towards the environment, geopolitical issues that have come to the forefront about how so much that happens in the world today are driven by energy issues, etc. All these things seem to me have come together at this particular point in history where, as with the development of the internet, you talked about, converging trends and things coming together. It's my opinion and feeling that we're at that point right now with sort of the consumer culture of this country being ready to embrace spending maybe even a little bit more money to purchase things that they know are responsible and they know are geopolitically responsible. If you want to bring those issues into play as well. Do you agree with that? And that said, what I've heard all the people in the room seem to have experience starting businesses in this area, what I've heard, I think, to the person say is stop treating ideas about eco-entrepreneurship as if they belong on the fringe. Start thinking about them the same as you would any single other business idea. Frame your business plan, your ideas, your presentation in a way that make good business sense.
Absolutely.
So that whoever you're selling it to, whether it's the individual consumer once you finally get to the marketplace or the people who are going to have to fund you to get to that point, you have just as good a business plan that isn't relying on emotion, that's relying on hard facts and numbers. That said, there is the emotional factor that relates back to the first part of my thesis, that is, people are ready to take this leap and this jump, and that's why better marketing is needed to bring this kind of consumer responsibility into sort of the sexy mainstream, for lack of, you can tell I started out in Hollywood, into that mainstream of people's thinking consciousness. And
I'm going to have to
respond to that, I appreciate it.
So I think that we must also keep, I think yes is the answer. We're here, right? I mean, Ethos is an example of that. And walk through any Whole Foods store. Look at the amazing growth rate that company has seen. It is proof positive that that is happening. People will pay more for products they believe are better for themselves or better for the world. We also must keep in mind that, Aspen surely is not a representative sample set of this country. And so, EDLP and low price still matters most to people who are living on minimum wage or just north of that. So I think what I have hope that we'll see sustainability, if you will, integrated into businesses across the board because all consumers will demand it. And it won't necessarily just be those products that carry a premium price, though there's a huge opportunity there, but it'll be all products across the board.
Andrew? Yeah, I'd just say make the product better, and it's not a question then of paying a premium. You're actually just paying for the value created. And that's there are light greens and dark greens on the beachhead, but to get the bulk of the bell curve of consumers, of purchasers, you've got to just create a better value proposition.
And you better have, your business plan better be as good as the next guy's who's not sustainable. See, no one cuts you any slack, that's for sure. Investors better get the same return.
Yeah. Well, I'm committed to landing this plane on time, and it's time right now. So, it's not United if it's going to. So I want to thank Jonathan and Andrew for. I want to thank you first for your participation, but also for the incredible work you both are doing. I think it's not only, it's an inspiration to all of us, and I think a lot of people learned a lot here. But anyway, I wanted to ask the two of you to join me in thanking the audience for doing such a great job.
Thanks, sir.
That was fun.